From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Stock markets inch slightly upward at the open today, but it's a drop in the bucket after that dramatic 800-point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average yesterday, one of the biggest ever one-day sell-offs on Wall Street. Strong retail sales and numbers helped ease some investors' concerns today of a looming economic slowdown, a recession. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
So first, we always hear stocks are for the long haul. Investors shouldn't panic, shouldn't react to fluctuations. But what are economists saying about this big drop?
You know, I don't miss the markets beat at magazines and whatnot. Whenever there'd be a sell-off, the editors would scramble the jets like, you know, America's waiting with bated breath. What are the experts saying? I mean, this is the cost of admission to investing. Sell-offs happen. 800 points is a lot in absolute terms, very little in relative terms. And go back on YouTube and look at the crash of 87.
I'd rather not.
Points. No, but it's so quaint in the grand scheme of things. So either you're going to be in it and you know that you have to deal with volatility, which is omnipresent, or just stick your money in cash.
But was this different? I mean, on Tuesday, President Trump blinked in his trade war with China, putting off a portion of that new set of tariffs against China till after the Christmas shopping season. Some said maybe for political purposes. But also yesterday, there were new signs of an economic slowdown, a future recession. You know, so what were they? And is that what triggered the drop? Not the as much the tariffs?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, Germany recorded negative growth in the latest quarter. China's growth in industrial output fell to a 17-year low, even though they have gangbusters growth compared to the United States. For our part, you know, we're 120 months into this economic expansion out of the Great Recession. That's the longest in 18 years. Since 1854. So everybody is worried, how are we going to come out of this? Is there going to be global stimulus, especially during a trade war? Other countries have negative interest rates. Do they even have interest rates to cut? And when you're talking about Germany, which has Europe on its shoulders, and you know, Asia is China, the biggest economic juggernaut there, that everybody is wondering, we're all connected, and how are we going to get out of the first slowdown if it does happen in maybe a decade?
But, you know, it does feel like a, you know, Chicken Little thing, in that we have been hearing about a looming recession for a long time now. And then now there's also this phrase we're also going to be hearing a lot about. We spoke of it yesterday, the dreaded inverted yield curve. This is the phenomenon having to do with treasury bonds. There's the long-term bonds, which require investors to lock up their money for a long time. So usually they get a higher return. The short-term bonds usually has a lower return. So what's happening and what does it mean?
You know, I should get a Peabody Award if your listeners come away from this actually knowing what this means and can talk about it at dinner, because it's like the holy grail of explanation is this inverted yield curve. Look, long and short, it's historically been the market flashing an upcoming recession. So the idea is if interest rates on short-term bonds are higher than the interest rates paid on long-term bonds, which, I mean, that shouldn't make sense. It suggests that investors and traders are so worried about the near-term future that they're piling into safer long-term investments. And they're betting that in our case, the Federal Reserve will have to slash interest rates. So get yield while you can. So even so, I mean, I half expect my mother-in-law to ask me why yields are so introverted.
Well, I think, that's a joke there. But what
tip
is
your
it?
Waiters.
But what does it what does it mean?
It's meaning that pretty much the traders are banking that we are going to approach an economic slowdown and the Fed's going to have to slash rates. The problem is that we have not had chunky interest rates coming out of this great recession. We came out of a period of emergency low interest rates, and the Fed hasn't had the chance to ratchet rates higher so they could have arrows in the quiver. So everybody is wondering how we bring this global economy back into a soft landing at a time when we are more interconnected than we've ever been in history.
Yeah. And this inverted yield curve, again, you can just Google it, has inverted before every recession since 1955.
That's right. And five times alone, I believe, since 1978. Having said that, it could be different this time in that we're coming off of such an unnatural interest rate period. You wouldn't expect recently with the stock market an all-time high and with us at full employment that interest rates for the Fed would have been this low to begin with. You would have thought that we'd go back to maybe where they were in 2007 or 2000, but that has not been the case.
Well, and President Trump would like them to go lower. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Robin, he just said it's been the longest expansion since 1854, not because something great was happening in 1854. That's when the records began. So there you go. Well, China has deployed members of the People's Armed Police Force to the border with Hong Kong as pro-democracy protests there enter their third month. And joining us now from Hong Kong is Baggio Lung, who is among the protesters. Baggio, tell us what you want to accomplish with these protests. What would be a political outcome that would satisfy you?
At the beginning, our demand is to ban the extradition bill amendment that proposed by the Hong Kong government that will make Hong Kong no longer a safe place to Hong Kong citizens. But till now, we have five demands that we want to achieve, including to promise our government must promise not to charge and arrest protesters after the whole movement, to withdraw the bill, and also to promise a democracy system like universal suffrage.
Do you think that that's remotely possible, that China would ever allow something like that?
Honestly, we think we are praying against the odds. However, if we do not change the system, we will suffer this kind of things, terrible things that year by year, and we don't want another movement like this.
Yesterday, we saw photos of protesters unveiling banners apologizing for the violence that happened earlier in the week. Do you regret anything that the activists have done so far?
We have the whole movement. We have more than 2 months of movement already. Mm-hmm. Of course, sometimes maybe protesters, maybe they will do something that is not favored by the public. However, I think at the beginning, the problem is caused by the government, Beijing government, Hong Kong government, and the police forces. If they choose to withdraw the bill from the beginning, everything would not happen. And so I think government should bear the responsibility that causing now Hong Kong into a dangerous place.
Are you worried about a military response from China?
Personally, I don't think they will have a military response. Hong Kong is the only international financial hubs that China can be used as a cash cow. And if they would want to react by military forces, they did it times before. Why they don't is because they cannot damage their only international financial hubs, especially in this kind of economic situation.
Do you think that the trade war with the United States is having any effect on the Hong Kong protest movement?
Indeed, this is helping. Trade war makes China's economic situation go worse. And China government, at this moment at least, they need Hong Kong to draw some financial resources, cash, to their economy.
What about the response from President Trump? He has not made a formal statement on the protests in Hong Kong, but yesterday he tweeted, "I have zero doubt that if President Xi wants to quickly and humanely solve the Hong Kong problem, he can do it." And he asked of a question of whether there should be a personal meeting between him and Xi. What do you think of the response to the protests from President Trump?
We sincerely pray that, including President Trump, including other government of the world and all freedom-loving people on earth, to stand against China. China is the enemy of humanity, and executioners, the Hong Kong police forces, and Carrie Lam government are also doing the same thing. So we sincerely pray that President Trump or other government to use all means and sanctions necessary should be used against Beijing government and Hong Kong government.
Are you concerned that even doing an interview like this is going to put you on the radar of people in China who will want to go after you, or just being in the protests in general?
Actually, I was in the radars already. Mm-hmm. And so this may not be my main concern. But protesters, our demand is to change Hong Kong to a safe place. And we don't want to live in such a terror.
And how long do you think that you're willing to go on with these protests until you get what you want?
I don't know, but as soon as we can. And people with power, I mean the government, I think they need to think, how long would they take to have a response to the majority of Hong Kongers who come out on the street, you know, very hot summer, and showing a very clear demand?
That's Bajie Leung, who is one of the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. He was also part of the 2014 Umbrella Movement and was elected to the Hong Kong Legislative Council back in 2016, but could not serve because he deliberately misread the oath of office and wore a banner reading Hong Kong is not China. Bajie Leung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
As Democrats continue to debate whether to begin impeachment proceedings against President Trump, they are certainly considering the country's last impeachment. In 1998, the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Bill Clinton after he was charged with lying under oath to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice. He was the second president to be impeached after Andrew Johnson in 1868. But the Senate acquitted Clinton. He was not removed, and he finished his term. Peter Baker was watching it all. He covered Clinton's impeachment for The Washington Post. He's author most recently, along with John Meacham, Tim Neftali, and Jeff Engel, of Impeachment and American History. And he is now chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. Peter Baker, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems like the Clinton impeachment and how it played out is, more than anything else, stopping the Democrats from moving forward on impeachment now. Is that your sense?
Well, in a way, that's right. Everybody, of course, fights the last battle. They are taking lessons from the Clinton impeachment experience and worry that they will repeat what they see as the mistake the Republicans made, which is to say that they pursued an impeachment that came across to the public anyway as partisan and, in effect, kind of backlashed against them. They're afraid that just like the Republicans did back then, they might be able to win an impeachment vote in the House, but they would lose the vote in a Senate trial, which requires a two-thirds majority. Mm-hmm. And then, the president now, like the president then, would claim that that was, you know, vindication rather than seeing it as accountability for misdeeds.
Okay, well, let's talk about what happened back then. Clinton had an affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky from 1995 to 1997. It became public in 98. He at first denied it, but eventually came clean in August of 98. Here he is in a televised address.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible.
Peter Baker, start us there. What was the political calculation for Republicans who, at that moment, decided to authorize an impeachment inquiry?
Well, you know, the issue, of course, was not that he had an affair. It was that he had been asked about this under oath and given a false answer, right? And the other allegation was that he had tried to obstruct this lawsuit that had been filed by Paul Jones, who alleged sexual harassment by the president, and had the right under the court's rulings to explore other instances of extramarital impropriety if it involved, a subordinate employee like a White House intern, because he was accused of telling or encouraging other people to lie about this. He was accused of encouraging them to hide this affair in a legal proceeding. That made it a legal issue, not just a moral or ethical issue. And that becomes a problem, right? Because a lot of Americans saw this really as just about sex. And a lot of Democrats would tell you, well, that's all the Republicans really cared about. It was a puritanical exercise to punish a president of the other party. But what the Republicans say is, okay, but you don't get an exemption from the law requiring you to tell a truth under oath and to cooperate with a legal proceeding just because it might be about sex. And so where is the line? That's the question that the Clinton impeachment really raised. Where is the line of accountability for our president. What constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors? When is a presidential action so severe that it merits removal from office? And when is it not serious enough to do that? And what do you do about that in that kind of circumstance?
Well, and Democrats were very critical of the investigation when it started. This is Democratic Florida Congressman Robert Wexler, who said this after Republicans voted to authorize the impeachment inquiry.
What are our priorities as a people and a nation going to be? Is it going to be our health care, our schools, our educational needs, our Social Security, stopping genocide and containing this world economic crisis? Or is it going to be Monica Lewinsky?
It is striking to hear that now and think that Republicans have been saying the same thing about the Mueller investigation, if you changed a few of the words and some of the names.
That's right. Look, obviously, we don't want to compare exactly what President Clinton was accused of and what President Trump was accused of, but some of the surround sound is pretty similar, right? If you're the party defending the president, you're saying that the investigation against him is a witch hunt. You're saying that it is costing us time and resources and money and attention that should be paid to more serious issues. You're saying that the party pursuing it is only partisan and, you know, motivated by political motives rather than genuine, interest in, accountability. And that you hear very much ringing in our ears today like you did 20 years ago.
Well, and here's what Republicans were saying. This is the then Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, in October of 98, one of the main people pushing to impeach Clinton.
This is something that each member should approach as an American based on their oath to uphold the Constitution as their oath of office. And I would hope that's the way to be dealt with next week. So I hope it wouldn't be Democrats and Republicans. It would be Americans.
Now, Peter, I remember watching on C-SPAN as some of these impeachment proceedings were going on. They went on for a long time. How long did it take and how contentious did it get?
Well, interestingly, it took less time from the delivery of Ken Starr's report to Congress to the vote on the House floor to impeach President Clinton than we have now had since Robert Mueller's report was made public. It was about 99 days, if I remember the number correctly. We're past that already. This time around, we haven't yet officially opened an impeachment inquiry, whether what one should be or should not. That's not for me to say, obviously. So it felt like it went on for a long time, partly because the investigation itself had gone on from January to August beforehand, and the country had no question gotten tired of it by that point. And that's something you also, again, see, a dynamic you see today. A lot of the country, particularly Republicans, but even some independents and perhaps some Democrats, have gotten tired of this conversation about the Russia interference and whether or not President Trump obstructed justice. And it does seem like it's gone on for a long time this time around, too.
Did any Democrats join Republicans in voting to impeach?
More than 30 Democrats joined Republicans to open an impeachment inquiry. Mm-hmm. Only 5 Democrats in the House voted to actually impeach President Clinton once that question came to the floor. Similarly, 5 Republicans went the other direction and said they were not going to vote to impeach him on the main articles that ended up getting approved. So it was a pretty party line vote.
Was there any question, as somebody who was covering this at the time, of whether the Senate would actually vote to remove him from office?
Well, in hindsight, everybody looks back and says, well, we always knew the way it was going to turn out. I don't think so. That's not the way it felt at the time. Now, look, Democrats controlled enough votes in the Senate to maintain an acquittal, right? You needed a 2/3 vote to convict him. Republicans didn't have 2/3 by themselves. That would mean a number of Democrats would have to agree to vote against the president in order to remove him from office. That was always something of a long shot, but it wasn't unthinkable. In fact, there was quite a number of moments in there where people feared that there could be sort of a race to the exits by Democrats who weren't very happy with President Clinton. In the end, that didn't happen. In the end, Democrats did stick together, and he won the trial in the Senate by a sizable vote. But there were moments where it felt like it could have gone in a different direction.
Okay, so I want to talk about 2 political implications of this. First of all, for the Republicans, what did this do to the Republicans politically that they went through this process and then didn't remove Clinton from office?
Well, it was seen as a mistake by Republicans. It was seen as something that was partisan and political. In fact, for some of them, it was seen as even hypocritical because a number of Republicans had their own extramarital affairs exposed during this whole process. Their argument, of course, was, well, we weren't asked about them under oath. We didn't lie to a federal grand jury. That's a different thing. The question is not adultery, but telling the truth to a, you know, a legal proceeding. But in any case, a lot of damage was done to Republicans. Now, what you hear today by Democrats who are urging this House to go forward with impeachment was, well, maybe they didn't really pay that much of a price. The Republicans did end up winning the next presidential election, George W. Bush in 2000.
Who ran, and, by the way, saying that he was going to restore honor and dignity to the White House.
Exactly, exactly. Overtly against President Clinton's immorality, as he would put it. And the Republicans held on to the Congress, even though they lost some seats in the 1998 midterm election. So you hear, you know, different takes on it today. But broadly, the historical judgment has been that, you know, it ended up being seen as a partisan impeachment. That's something that Democrats today don't want to repeat.
This was more than 20 years ago. Do you think it's still impacting our politics today?
Well, it is. And it's really interesting how it's gone through cycles of revisionist thinking, right? After the 9/11 attacks and during the Iraq War, there are a lot of people who look back on the Clinton impeachment and say, well, look how frivolous this was. Look what the country was busily occupying itself with instead of seeing the threat that was on the horizon. This was something that was not worthy of a full year of Washington's attention. But then over the last couple years, as the Me Too movement has arisen in the United States, I think that people are re-looking at President Clinton's behavior and re-evaluating it in a different lens, right? That the things that he was accused of at the time, not just with Monica Lewinsky, but with Kathleen Willey, certainly Juanita Broderick, Paula Jones, amounted to the kinds of things we today in the Me Too era have roundly condemned. And that while whether or not impeachment was the right course of action or not, you've even heard Democrats like Kirsten Gillibrand, now running for president, say that President Clinton should have resigned as a result of the accusations that were made against him. So it is interesting how history kind of comes in waves and we reevaluate these things depending on the current moment's politics.
That is Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, speaking with us about the impeachment of President Clinton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's always great talking to you.
And by the way, it was this weekend in 1998 that President Clinton made that famous statement on TV that he did have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky.
An historical clinical trial using Ebola antibodies appears to be saving the lives of people with Ebola. News that's reverberating in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is in the middle of a year-long Ebola outbreak. Helen Branswell is one of our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Helen, doctors at Regeneron, the company that produces this drug, told you they knew they were on the right track, but they're shocked at the success. How promising is this?
It looks really promising, and it's obviously really exciting because for decades, the world has had to respond to Ebola outbreaks without any drugs at all. You know, the best they could do was doctors could give patients fluids and try to keep them comfortable, but there wasn't really any kind of therapy to use. And now the study is suggesting that this drug could really improve people's chances of surviving, especially if they start to get it early.
Yeah, well, you spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a well-known name here in the U.S., and he said it means that we do have now what looks like treatments for a disease which not too long ago we really had no therapeutic approach to at all. And he's crediting the doctor who first proposed using blood from Ebola survivors.
Right. So Dr. Jean-Jacques Mayembe, who runs, who's sort of essentially Dr. Fauci's counterpart in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC has had 10 outbreaks more than any other country. And so he has responded time and time again over the decades. And back in 1995, I think, there was a big outbreak in a place called Kikwit. And he proposed using taking blood from people who had previously survived Ebola Ebola and transfusing it into Ebola patients to see if it would help. His theory was that they would contain antibodies that would help people fight off the virus. It's been a work in progress, and a bunch of different companies have tried to come up with something that would work on this approach. And now it really looks like this Regeneron drug that you were mentioning, which is kind of based on that theory, may actually do the trick.
Well, and that's wonderful. People are, as we said, shocked and excited about this. But what are some concerns? We know that there's so much distrust, for instance, in the DRC of aid workers. And so how will this work going forward?
What people really hope is that the word will get out that Ebola is something that can be cured. That if you go to a treatment center, especially if you go to a treatment center quickly, your chances of surviving are quite high, because up until now, people have associated treatment centers with places that only coffins emerge from. If the new narrative can take hold, if people start to believe that there is something that can be done for them, perhaps they will show up and agree to be treated, in which case one could start to see the death rate come down, which in turn should really help with the trust problems that the outbreak response workers have been having. But it's a big if. You know, it won't happen overnight. People have to sort of come to conclude that these places are safe for them to go or to bring their loved ones to.
Yeah. Well, but still, staying with the headline, this clinical trial has shown that two therapies from Ebola antibodies appear to improve survival rates. Really something to celebrate in the Ebola outbreak there. Helen Branswell, senior writer for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, we've been talking about the Grand Canyon and its 100th anniversary as a national park. Over that 100 years, and long before that, the canyon has inspired artists, writers, and musicians who visited it. And today, we're going to wrap up our series with the music of the Grand Canyon. Claire Hoffman is the co-founder and artistic director of the annual Grand Canyon Music Festival. Claire, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, and first of all, tell us about your own experience hiking in the Grand Canyon and how it led you to founding this music festival.
Well, it goes back 37 years. I was a young musician in New York City struggling to find my way, and I happened to pick up a book by Willa Cather called The Song of the Lark, which serendipitously is about a young musician trying to find her way. And a friend of hers says, look, just go to the canyons of northern Arizona and forget about music and just figure out what you want to do. And so I said, I got to go to the canyons of northern Arizona. Mm-hmm. So my husband and I, Robert Bonfilio, who's the other co-founder of the Grand Canyon Music Festival, packed our instruments in our backpacks. I have a flute, and he had his harmonica, and we went down into the Grand Canyon. And we had planned a rim-to-rim-to-rim hike. The first day down, we took our instruments out and played by the Colorado River, and we were not aware of it, but there was a ranger down there who heard the music, didn't know where it was coming from. Next day, we packed up, and my husband and I hiked up the floor of the canyon to Cottonwood Campground and did the same thing, took our instruments out, and were playing. And the ranger had also walked up the canyon, and this time he was determined to find us. He did, and said, look, can you come into the ranger's cabin after dinner and play us a concert?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after 2 days of hiking in the Grand Canyon, you're really hot and tired.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, fine. So we went in and played some music and just had a wonderful time talking to them. And we left there, and all my husband could talk about was this place needs a music festival.
Huh.
That was the founding of the Grand Canyon Music Festival.
Okay, well, at this point, mm-hmm. I think we have to play some music so that people can get in the mood here. This is the Grand Canyon Suite. This is by mm-hmm. the American composer Ferdy Groffay. It was completed in 1931. Let's listen to some of it. First, here's a bit from the movement Sunrise. And then I want to hear another part of this. This is another movement called On the Trail. Yeah. just see a little squirrel hopping along as you're walking along the trail there in the Grand Canyon.
I think it's the mules he's trying
the mules, okay.
to bring to mind there, yeah.
Well, tell us about this one, the Grand mules. Canyon Suite.
Well, Ferdo Groffé was, today he's pretty much exclusively known as the composer of the Grand Canyon Suite, but he was a really highly regarded jazz musician. He was a fine jazz pianist. This is kind of a very programmatic piece, as you noticed. It's like, oh, it's the mules. It's the animals hopping around the canyon. For, you know, better or for worse, when people talk about music in the Grand Canyon, that's what they think of. But I have to tell you, we have never played the Grand Canyon Suite in 36 years at the Grand Canyon Music
Why
Festival.
Why not?
Well, in part because it's symphonic work and we are really chamber music. I think at one time or another we thought, wouldn't it be kind of fun to kind of arrange one or two movements to do it, but there's just so much other stuff that we want to do that's taken priority, really. You know, we've had Pulitzer Prize-winning composers joining us and commissioning new works of music inspired by the Grand Canyon, having our Native American Composer Apprentice Project, students from the Navajo and Hopi Nations writing new music. So, you know, it's a fun piece, and maybe someday we'll do an arrangement of it.
Okay, well, let's listen to another thing that is on your agenda. This is one of many that the Grand Canyon Music Festival has commissioned over the years. This is called Guardians of the Grand Canyon, composed by Brent Michael Davids. It's got the same idea behind it, it sounds like to me, which is that, mm-hmm. You know, it's peaceful and yet it's so grand that you never know what's going to happen.
Right. In 2000, the Grand Canyon Music Festival was chosen to be the Arizona host site for a nationwide millennial project. And we were asked to commission a composer to write a piece that would reflect our community. And we chose Brent Michael Davids, who's a member of the Mohican Nation. And he came to the Grand Canyon, and he wanted to meet the Havasupai, who are still living in the canyon.
Right.
He really thought it was important, and I agree completely with him, that we talk about and celebrate the people of the canyon. Mm-hmm. And so he created this piece, which is really the Havasupai Ram Dance. So what you heard is the four flutes and two percussionists. We had a metal flute, which is what I play. Brent has a crystal flute that he made, a native wooden flute, cedar flute, and a clay flute, and then two percussionists. And at the end of the piece, you hear the Havasupai Ram dancers sing their traditional song along with our performance. Many of the original First Peoples of the Grand Canyon, whether it's the Havasupai or the Hopi or the Hualapai, the Navajo, just to name a few, and music and art is not separate from daily life. It's not something they put in a box and take out every once in a while to admire. It's really an extension, an expression of the beauty that surrounds us. And certainly when you're at the Grand Canyon, you see that beauty. It is surrounding you all the time. And it's kind of what we think about when we think about putting together a festival every year and the music we want to play, the reverence that I think is appropriate when we're in this place that really is kind of our national shrine. Mm-hmm. The ranger I spoke about earlier, Joe Quiros, he calls it our Notre Dame.
Well, and by the way, we spoke the other day with a councilwoman for the Havasupai as part of our Grand Canyon 100-year series. So people can check that out at hereandnow.org. But I want to listen to one more piece that you wanted us to hear. This is Puhutawi, composed by Clark Tenakongva and Trevor Reed. Here's part of the fifth movement. Tell us about this piece.
Trevor Reed is a young Hopi composer. He was actually one of our teachers in our Native American Composer Apprentice Project. And when he was working with us on that, he said, you know, I'm also working on this new piece with Hopi traditional singer Clark Nakhungva. We're really trying to synthesize traditional Hopi music with sort of, I never know what to call it, Western European music. So in 2016, we premiered Puhutawi, which was really co-composed, Trevor and Clark working together to create this new, they call it sort of a new genre of Hopi music. And we had two string quartets and percussion, and you also heard traditional Hopi percussion as well as Clark singing.
Well, let me ask you finally then, what is it like to listen to the music in the canyon? Because there's the idea of music being about the canyon, but also it must be different to just hear it when you're in it.
It's wonderful. It's really, I mean, I have played my flute in the canyon. It's really quite weird because sometimes you can't hear the echoes, but I've been told, you know, somebody say there's like four or five echoes going on at the same time.
Wow.
It's such a big place, but you can't hear it where you are. And it is very, you know, inspiring is too simple a word. As I said, it's very moving. There's this reverence that we bring and this idea of art and music not being separate but a part of who we are when we celebrate the beauty around us, the world we live in, and the values that we have.
You know, it's interesting that you say inspiring is too simple a word because I think about the Grand Canyon and think that everything is too simple to describe it, to, you know, pay homage to it, anything. It's just so huge. That's Claire Hoffman, who is a musician and co-founder and artistic director of the Grand Canyon Music Festival. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The sound of flute in the Grand Canyon. I said no to the Super Bowl. You need me, I don't need you.
Every night we in the end zone. Tell the NFL we in stadiums too. Last night was That's music mogul and hip-hop's first billionaire Jay-Z on a track from his latest album, The Carters, with his superstar wife Beyoncé, in a song in which he criticizes the NFL. Now he's working with them. This week, Jay-Z and his entertainment company, Roc Nation, sealed a deal with the NFL to bolster their live music entertainment and further social justice efforts. Let's talk more about it with Here Now sports analyst Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, just start. Thoughts. Jay-Z, deal. Official title, live music entertainment strategist.
Oh, yes. How did all the leagues get by without one of those all these years? So let's talk about the incentives from each side. From the NFL side, it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Jay-Z is more than just someone who knows music and can supply them with musicians, including maybe himself and his wife. He's someone who has enormous credibility within the African-American community, within the economic community. I would say that, you know, almost every player in the NFL said about this deal, ooh, look who the NFL has partnered with, much more so than they said, ooh, look who the NFL's wireless provider is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as Jay-Z's side, to quote the lyric you just played, I said no to the Super Bowl. You need me. I don't need you. Mm. So I'm going to guess that there are maybe a couple things going on, an enormous amount of money. But also, you know, he's been a huge champion of Colin Kaepernick. And it would seem at least curious to me if he went into this without some assurances that the NFL is going to do what it can to get the formerly very good quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers another shot should Colin Kaepernick want it.
You can't imagine Jay-Z would sign on without that.
I think it would hurt. You know, we all have our credibility and we all build up, you know, we have repositories of goodwill over the years. And Jay-Z has a lot, but I think he would be spending down an enormous amount of it if there was no plan to address some of these more underlying concerns, because the cynic, and when it comes to the NFL, it is proper to be cynical. And by the way, cynical just means you think that other people put their self-interest first. And of course, a profit-seeking organization like the NFL will do it. Anyway, the cynic will say, well, is this just some sort of PR stunt? Is this Jay-Z gets paid off off, and then the NFL gets absolved on how right. maybe tone-deaf and slow-footed it's been on things like protesting the national anthem. So, Jay-Z can do whatever Jay-Z wants, and he's going to make some money off that. But if that winds up being the case, he will take a reputational hit.
And Mike, maybe odd question, and I don't mean to be flip. I'm genuinely curious. If maybe this is a reaction to, the Super Bowl in which Adam Levine and Maroon 5 played, and this was largely because Cardi B and Rihanna had turned it down because of Colin Kaepernick and their siding with him. But it felt awfully white.
Right. It was in Atlanta, and you have like every rapper known to man being from Atlanta, and the NFL is like, what is this hip hop thing you're talking about? Absolutely that it was odd for Maroon 5 to perform. I don't think that you go to these lengths just because you had one halftime booking that was maybe suboptimal. Okay. From the NFL's perspective, they have an enormous amount of money. And if Jay-Z is willing to partner with you, you at least send a signal to all your constituencies, which as much as they don't want to admit it, include the players, you send a signal, okay, maybe we're open to talk about social justice a little more. And, explicitly part of this was the NFL going to Jay-Z about social justice issues. And so right now, maybe there are a lot of people saying, Jay-Z, were you just paid off? It takes someone to make a half step, takes another party to make a half step, and maybe you get somewhere in terms of making actual progress based on the fact that you have people with excellent reputations in their communities who could broker a peace, if you will.
Well, the NFL takes a risk here, too, because the last thing they want is Jay-Z to say, I quit. It didn't work. They didn't do anything.
Yeah. And there's a guy who wore a pro Kaepernick shirt on SNL when he didn't have to. And his opinions are out there and well known. And we just heard his lyrics. And if he does that, it will really damage the NFL's reputation. They can't afford that.
Yeah. How have fans reacted?
I think most fans are a little, there's a whole bunch of football fans. Some of them are grumpy. The game's gotten soft, guys. Who's like, who is this Jays, right? Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't exactly go by their opinion. But I do especially think some of the fans who are sympathetic to players' concerns see this as a potential step towards maybe the NFL being something other than the worst of the professional sports leagues when it comes to treating the concerns of its athletes and taking the concerns of its athletes seriously.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.